All right, before I introduce our guest speaker, I'm going to read to you aloud the scriptures that he's going to be using today, just to save him a little time on that. So those are on the back of your bulletin. So the first one is coming from Matthew 14, 1 through 12. It says, at that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the reports about Jesus, and he said to his attendants, "This is John the Baptist. He is risen from the dead. That is why miraculous powers are at work in him." Now Herod had arrested John and bound him and put him in prison because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for John had been saying to him, "It's not lawful for you to have her." Herod wanted to kill John, but he was afraid of the people because they considered John a prophet. On Herod's birthday, the daughter of Herodias danced for the guests and pleased Herod so much that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. Prompted by her mother, she said, "Give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist." The king was distressed, but because of his oaths and his dinner guests, he ordered that her request be granted and had John beheaded in the prison. His head was brought in on a platter and given to the girl who carried it to her mother. John's disciples came and took his body and buried it, and then they went and they told Jesus. Next verse, John 17, 20 to 21. This is Jesus speaking. "My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me." And finally, Romans 12, 18. "If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone." Now I'm going to introduce Dr. Gushy. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to read a few of the bio things so I make sure I get them right, and then I'll offer a little personal note here. So the Reverend Dr. David Gushy is the Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics at Mercer University, that's in Atlanta, Chair of Christian Social Ethics at the Free University in Amsterdam, Senior Research Fellow at the International Baptist Theological Study Center. You're a Baptist of the like Jimmy Carter vein, right? The Cooperative Baptists. He is the elected past president of both the American Academy of Religion and the Society of Christian Ethics. He has authored or edited or co-those more than 29 books. Many of you have read his books, Changing Our Mind, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies, many other things. Lots of other credentials. The thing I will offer personally, those of you who have seen David preach here before, he's been a friend to our congregation over the last decade since we started. So if you're newer, you may not know just the personal connection was my seminary class at Fuller. He was the co-author of my ethics textbook. And so he and Ken became friends as Ken was changing his mind on LGBTQ inclusion in the church. And so David was a real friend to me as I was coming out. He was on the phone with me, praying with me and for me the morning I had to come out from the pulpit. And has just been a great advisor and friend ever since. And so he is very dear to me. He's very dear to this church. And I ask that we just welcome him with a great welcome, great and hearty welcome. Yeah.
Thank you so much, dear Emily. It's so good to be back here with you today. I miss my friend Ken. He and his family are suffering in England at this time. So when you see him again, make him feel guilty. Yeah. He needs more of that in his life, I think. So it is indeed good to be back in one of my favorite churches in the world. I'm here at your pastor's invitation to reflect on issues relevant to the election season that we are in. So you may know that there's an election happening. You may have seen a handful of political advertisements over the last several months. I think a lot about these things, partly because I'm a Christian ethicist, partly because I also live in a swing state. I'm in Georgia, you're in Michigan, so we're, because of the odd electoral college system that we find ourselves in and the way our country is set up, the way our population is distributed, seven states will decide the election, and we are two of them. And so it seems appropriate to have this conversation here. Also, I know that you have a major U.S. Senate thing happening, and whoever Michigan elects for the Senate may help determine the makeup of the leadership there. As you also undoubtedly know, at the presidential level, the race is incredibly close, the closest polling in our lifetime. And the U.S. Senate and House are both so closely divided that nobody knows how it's all going to wash out after Tuesday, November 5th. So you know all of this. But I've called this a pre-election pastoral word to Blue Ocean Church. Footnote, blame Emily if you don't like this, okay? She asked me to comment on some specific pastoral concerns, and I've been doing a lot of this. For the last 3 months, I've been going around the country speaking to, mainly to churches, about how to interpret the moment we find ourselves in. What does Jesus have to do with any of it? What does the gospel have to do with any of it? What does Christian citizenship, if there is such a thing, look like? How do we deal with all of this? Now, it is often said in ethics that the first question we must ask, and it's actually not a bad question for all of us to ask, when entering a difficult situation, the first question is, what is going on? Now, we might say, if we were a little more crude, whatever is going on? What is going on? Well, so that's the first question, and that's where I'll mainly camp out this morning. What is going on? Another way to say it is, what is the problem? What is the problem that we find ourselves in? This assumes that we have a problem. If you don't think we're having any problems in our political life, you're free to go at this time. So what's the problem? It is possible to argue quite plausibly that the most fundamental problem that we have in the U.S. right now is extreme polarization. More technically, extreme binary polarization. That is, two teams, we call them these days red and blue, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. Now, it's interesting just even to start there, the fact that it's two teams, not multiple teams. There's not seven sides, there's really two. That actually ratchets up the tension in some ways, I think. And because it's win-lose, it's not like in a parliamentary system, usually like in Europe, there's five or six or seven parties. We've got two. And they're just so stubbornly opposed to each other. Polls during this election year show about equal support for the two teams. The election will likely be decided by tiny slivers of difference in a few states that'll satisfy nobody that any issues actually got resolved. Two teams whose most ardent loyalists increasingly disdain, fear, and maybe even hate each other. A political reality in which it is common to hear people say things like, I don't see how anyone could see it the other way. Or I don't see how any Christian could vote for that side, or how any rational human could vote for that side. That's different. It really wasn't that way when I was coming through. Things have changed. Having a population that has fallen prey to extreme binary polarization with election results usually incredibly close puts a great deal of strain on the political system. I think especially of the scrutiny and pressure and even manipulation that falls upon the humble, locally controlled electoral processes. I went to vote this week in Georgia. Just regular people running election stations under enormous scrutiny from a increasingly distrustful population. If candidates win by hundreds of thousands of votes, and if there weren't as much mistrust, the details of how absentee ballots are handled or whether you have this kind of voting machine versus that kind of voting machine, it wouldn't really matter. But when elections are decided by less than one half of 1%, it becomes much more difficult to manage the process and to protect confidence in it. Of course, when bad actors attempt to undermine our confidence in the elections, that makes it all the worse. A lot is what we see. When I went to the polls this week, I saw good-hearted people doing their best. But some of us are being taught to see malign actors manipulating the system. But of course, these divisions are not only a problem for our politics, they are an interpersonal problem for regular people like you and me. Everywhere I travel these days, I run into people who are describing with great pain their difficult relationships with family members and with maybe friends or former friends or maybe about to be former friends who find themselves on the other team, the red or the blue team. Emily asked me to address this issue today. I blame her. No, I mean, this is everywhere, isn't it? Can I just ask you to raise your hand if you have a tense relationship with somebody you matter over politics? For if you're watching at home, that was about 90% of the room. Most often, given who invites me places, part of polarization is I'm only mainly invited to center and left-leaning places, right? So mainly, who I talk to are people who are on the blue team, essentially experiencing deep and painful alienation from family members. The most painful cases are not just about the fact that they are voting differently from me, but that they have gone around the bend toward a kind of extremism, conspiratorial QAnon or whatever kind of politics that is so odd to us, so extreme and so disturbing that it makes relationships very difficult to sustain. It's one thing to have different opinions from somebody we care about. It's another thing to inhabit a different reality. I don't even live in the same reality as you. How do we even have a conversation? There was a stage in my journey where the problem of polarization was the main problem that I was attempting to address. So I wrote about strategies of dialogue and building bridges of conflict resolution and peacemaking. I wrote books with titles like Christians and Politics Beyond the Culture Wars. That was 30 years ago. How are we doing, you know? I talked about cultivating what I called an evangelical center, a moderate middle, but that was a long time ago. It feels like a million years ago, really. It does not appear that we're going to be getting beyond our culture wars differences anytime soon, and I am long past thinking that evangelicalism is salvageable or will ever yield a center, nor do I even think the moderate middle is the goal anymore, though there are times that I kind of, why can't we all just find a nice spot in the middle, you know? So I want to say this pastoral word. If you find yourself up to your eyeballs in tensions with family members or friends over politics, I want to say that that's very, very painful and that I've dealt with it too with immediate family members and that family relationships matter and that old friendships matter, that dialogue is worth attempting still, that we need to look for ways to try to build bridges, any kind of bridge, towards people with whom we find ourselves across the political chasms. Also, I would say that while sometimes it is time to talk directly about differences with family members and friends, sometimes it is time to avoid doing so. Sometimes it's time to go outside and throw the football around. Yeah. Sometimes it's time to talk about, you know, what are you streaming these days? Oh, that's a cool show. Or to talk about, you know, how the University of Georgia is better than the University of Michigan this year. There is a trend documented of more and more people breaking relationships with their families over political differences, where people no longer talk. This happened in my extended family, where conversation was impossible for 2 years between a mother and a son because of politics. I would say that this is an unfortunate development. If we can stay in the conversation with our loved ones, however difficult, we should try under normal circumstances. That doesn't mean that we lie or dissemble or pretend to be okay with things we're not okay with. But it means we try to keep the thread of the conversation alive. Find some way to continue the relationship. That seems right to me as a Christian. Of course, there are exceptions around safety and mental health. But the default setting for Christians is to try. And that's why I asked for the Romans 12 passage, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Notice how careful Paul is there. He doesn't just say, live at peace with everyone. He says, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, keep the door open. Try. Live at peace to the extent that you can. And the John 17 passage, Jesus prays that fellow Christians would have unity. I've spent a 30-year career grieving over the disunity of the Christian church in America. I've been in the middle of awful fights over LGBT inclusion and other issues. But the biblical teachings about trying to live in peace and trying to pursue unity should still stick to the ribs. They should still be there. We cannot rest easy with a divided church as we have it in the U.S. today. We cannot rest easy with broken core relationships in our life as if, whatever. If we no longer feel the tension between the call to peace and the call to unity and the array of brokenness that we have, if that just doesn't even register with us anymore, we may need to be called back to taking seriously that the call to peacemaking and the call to unity. Part of what happens when people think they're at war, whether it's spiritual war or cultural war, is they grow easy with conflict and even sometimes violence. So may that not be us. Okay, so that's my first point. So, but I go on here to kind of pivot in a different direction. I said that there was a stage in my life where I thought the main problem was polarization. At this moment, I don't actually think the main problem is polarization. At this moment, the main problem is, to my view, a version of Christianity that I call authoritarian and reactionary Christianity. That's the theme of my book on democracy that came out last year, that I think Emily has mentioned here. And it's what I think is the most important problem at this moment, which is a judgment call, but I'd like to describe what I mean by it. Authoritarian, reactionary Christianity, it sounds like, wow, look at all those syllables. There's a lot of syllables there. You can abbreviate it down to ARC. ARC, and the way I say it in my book is, you know how Dr. King said the arc of the universe bends towards justice? ARC is attempting to bend the arc of the universe backwards towards the way things used to be. A better past in the view of the people who hold this view. In the view of me, a not as good past. Christian nationalism is another term for the idea that I'm describing, but I don't think Christian nationalism is as descriptive as this language of authoritarianism and reactionary Christianity. So let me try to unpack that a little bit. In politics, authoritarianism happens when popular sovereignty, that is the rule of the people, is weakened. When power is centralized in the hands of one person or group, when the rule of law is undercut, when free and fair elections are no longer available or they're weakened, when freedom of speech is threatened or limited, when the power of the state is misused to weaken or eliminate political opponents, when the criminal justice system is manipulated to go after those who think differently or who vote differently, when the judiciary is manipulated so that it no longer renders fair judgments, when civil rights and civil liberties protections are taken away. That's authoritarianism. This is the path that anti-democratic leaders have taken all over the world. It describes what it's like to live in a country like China or North Korea or Russia. All the things I just described, that's what it's like there. No freedom of the press, no freedom of speech, no free and fair elections. The courts and judiciary used to attack people, no due process, no civil liberties. If you are in Russia and you say the wrong thing, you can end up out a window. It happens all the time. But there's also a spectrum of kind of movement in the direction of authoritarianism that you also have to pay attention to. A country doesn't have to be as far gone as China, North Korea, or Russia to be on the way to authoritarianism or to be part of the way there. I think of what it's like to live in Hungary under Viktor Orban or in Turkey today. Authoritarianism is reflected in this horrifying passage from Matthew 14. King Herod could do whatever King Herod wanted to do. So King Herod arrested John on no legitimate grounds, imprisoned him on no legitimate grounds, and then executed him on a whim. That's what it's like to live in an authoritarian country. Do you know the name Alexei Navalny?
Yeah.
The Russian dissident arrested, ends up dead conveniently. This should matter to us. In an autocracy, one person rules, no one can challenge them. Well, if you do challenge them bravely, like Navalny, you lose your security, you lose your freedom, and you may lose your life. I fear that Americans so take for granted that we don't live in an autocracy or an authoritarian state that they think it could never be possible that we would. But, and here I'll have to name a name, Donald Trump exhibits clear authoritarian tendencies, and that's the main thing that Christians should be concerned about, in my opinion. Both things that he has said and things that he has threatened on this campaign trail are clearly authoritarian measures. People who are committed to democracy here and around the world, that is what they work on. I mean, I've gotten to speak to democratic advocacy organizations and so on. People who study this, the main thing about Donald Trump is that he's an authoritarian in a democratic country who, if given power again, could take us down the path towards where Hungary is or beyond. The rule of one, law being what the ruler declares it is, that's authoritarianism. Now, here's the problem that is so our business. Here and in multiple countries, many Christians have demonstrated a susceptibility to want authoritarianism. This sometimes happens in left-wing, like socialist or communist regions, but it's far more common on the right wing of the spectrum. If you think about the history of Christianity with honesty, we have to acknowledge that many Christians exhibit authoritarian tendencies. Not even talking about politics. Maybe some of you grew up in homes where the idea was that one man, usually almost always a man, had ultimate authority to determine the will of God, to direct the affairs of the church / family / school / whatever, and to enforce his will however he chose, with no right of appeal, no freedom of speech, no dissent, no conversation. Does that ring any bells? Christianity has an authoritarian history in it. What I think has happened is that in democratic countries, this authoritarianism has generally been bracketed off to the family and the church. So you have authoritarians running dictatorships in the local church or in the male-dominated family. Dad, what dad says goes, what the pastor says goes. Not able to do that in the political arena because we live in a democracy where everybody gets a vote. But what would happen if authoritarian-leaning Christians decided that what we needed in a country was the kind of authoritarianism that they exhibit in their homes? What if they became attracted to a politician who promised that kind of authoritarianism in public life. The dream of having a country that looks like the authoritarian Gothard-like family or Dobson-like vision, that dream is on the table right now. I use the term reactionary to describe what is mobilizing a lot of people towards authoritarianism. Many Christians have settled into a posture of deep negative reaction to cultural trends that they don't like. This is really the entire story of the Christian right since at least the 60s. Do you know anybody who, if you ask them, would say yes to the following statements? They don't like the fading of Christianity in America. They wish America was more religious. They don't like the abandonment of moral beliefs that are now called old-fashioned. They don't like the lifestyle changes that have liberalized social norms. They don't like the feeling that their kind of people have less power and have been displaced from power. Some of them don't like a more multi-ethnic, multiracial America. They don't like the fact that a lot of people seem to be doing better economically than they are. They feel that elites in higher education and culture are actively working against their values. They believe that some institutions in government are actively working against their values. If you know people like that, they have settled, especially if they're really, really angry about all of this, they've settled into what can be described as a reactionary posture. The world is against them. The elites and the power structure is against them. They want to overturn that reality. They want to take America back. They want America to be the America they imagined or envisioned that it was, say, in 1934 or 1952 or something like that. So what I think we have right now is Christian authoritarianism linked up with fiercely negative reaction to cultural changes that include the women's movement, immigration, gay rights, abortion, civil rights, you name it, and there's 100 other things. A great big no to all the changes since the 60s, and they want to reverse all of that, to bend the arc of American history back. And they're looking for somebody who can help them do that. And for some of them, they are sufficiently authoritarian and sufficiently reactionary that protecting democracy is less important for them than bending the arc of history back to the way things used to be. They would trade our democracy for banning abortion, reversing gay rights, reestablishing white supremacy in every area, pushing the immigrants out, because that is what matters more to them. So, what I have been saying is this authoritarian reactionary Christianity is at the core of the gravest threat to American democracy probably since the internment camps of the Japanese during World War II. But if we see it that way, and it really matters to us, that might just place us in a position of chronic conflict with people on the other team who say things like, oh, you're overreacting. Oh, it's just bluster. Oh, you're just panicking. You're watching too much MSNBC, you know, whatever. And there you end up with that dilemma. I want to live in peace with everyone and try to keep family relationships open, and yet I believe a very serious challenge to the democratic system that we value is happening, and that is where we live. I wonder if that resonates with anybody. So, I don't have a lot of answers, but I have a few things I'd like to say to wrap up. We need a better Christianity, and we need a better democracy. You already, here at Blue Ocean, have already rejected reactionary forms of Christianity. If you are here, you probably know that the way of Jesus has nothing to do with protecting patriarchy, white supremacy, xenophobia, cisgender dominance, heteronormativity, and the idea that white, straight, male Christians should be in charge of everything. You've rejected that because exhibited by the fact that you're here. You would not be the church that you are, or have the leaders that you have, or hear the gospel as it is proclaimed here, if you thought that the way of Jesus was reactionary, make America 1952 again. You also undoubtedly know and love the Jesus who was always on the margins, who was always challenging the power structures of his world, who got everybody mad at him, who was in conflict with the Sadducees and the Herodians and the Pharisees and the lawyers and the scribes and his own family, for standing up for those precisely marginalized by people who wanted to make Israel great again. The Jesus who refused any kind of ethnocentrism, who went to the margins, who said that this is where God is to be found. So you already know that authoritarian, reactionary Christianity is not the way of Jesus. It's a negation of the way of Jesus, which is one reason why it is very hard for us to remain in comfortable community with fellow Christians, even fellow family members who have gone down that road. But I also want to offer this word. Our democracy is pretty dang messed up. That's strong language for me right there, people. Southern Baptist background, they beat the cursing right out of me, you know. Part of the reason we are where we are is that the functioning of our democracy is pretty broken. Now, I still want to say that renewing that democracy is worth fighting for. Resisting authoritarians like Trump and many, many Trumps is worth doing. There is a real difference between how people live in Russia and in China and in North Korea and here. So far, I don't have to worry about being thrown into jail for what I am saying to you today. So far. Did you notice the Washington Post made an odd decision this week? They decided not to endorse anybody for president. Some people think that that was what's called obedience in advance, so as to avoid reprisals on January 21st. That is what happens when authoritarianism comes your way. I have much more high visibility dissenting people than me already concerned about what will happen to them after January 20th. And you don't have to be prosecuted. All you have to be is harassed, threatened. Now, I do want to say, I do meet many people who are very disillusioned with how U.S. democracy works, very disillusioned with what the two parties offer, very disillusioned with what the Democrats have offered on economic life or on Israel, Palestine, Gaza, with how many problems never seem to get solved, with the conservative turn on immigration issues visible in the Democratic presidential campaign this year, with the dysfunctional nature of our legislature and the alarming trends in our judiciary. I know people who are flirting with a kind of a burn-it-all-down nihilism. Why should I care? It's broken. Never was worth anything. I would say to you that in politics, relative differences do still matter, though. We will not have the ideal until the eschaton when Jesus comes back. What we should want today is a little bit better rather than a little bit worse. I think that preserving our democratic system is more than a little bit better. It's a lot better. It's not a world of equality and social justice, but it is the presupposition of ongoing efforts within politics to pursue a better world. People are being asked polling questions like, what are your main voting issues this year? Inflation, immigration, Israel, or democracy? To me, that's like asking, what do you think is more important in football, Offense, defense, special teams, or referees? You see what I'm saying? If you don't have fair referees who do their job right, you can't have offense, defense, or special teams. The referees are the presupposition of the game. You have the rules, and they are enforced fairly. Democracy is the game. The no other component of the game is as important as the game itself, if you see what I'm saying. One of these things is not like the other. My earnest hope is that after November 5th, the authoritarians among us will once again be defeated, as they mainly were in 2022 and 2020, that anti-reactionary, anti-authoritarian Christians like you all will help make that happen, and that together we can move beyond the state of emergency in which we find ourselves toward building a more just society, a renewed democracy, and a better version of the Christian faith. Let me offer a prayer. Lord, I've done my best today to call it as I see it. I leave this to you. I leave this community with you. I pray for our country with all my heart. I pray for our church with even more of my heart. I pray for outposts of your kingdom, of your reign, that are modeling anti-authoritarian, anti-reactionary way of Jesus faith. And whatever happens, that is always our agenda. We are not dependent on a political outcome, Lord, for us to be your people. May we be your people, faithful, resilient, trusting of you, committed to the way you have called us to. For your sake and in your name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, David. Thank you. That's a hard one to give.